Guys, I'm sorry about earlier. I stepped out for a second. I would blame it on Roger for not praying long enough so I can get back in here, but he'd take me out back and whoop me good, so I'm not going to do that. But we're back in 1 Samuel. It's going to be chapter 17. So what'd y'all think of that Bible Project video? Y'all like that stuff? They're really helpful to me. You know, I can read all this stuff and kind of make these pictures in my mind of how I think things are. But seeing somebody actually put the work in to do that and create all that, that's really cool. And that's just a talent I've never had. So I really admire people who have that type of artistic storytelling ability. I think that's really cool. So we're going to be in 1 Samuel 17. I'm going to read the first few verses. Verse 1 starts out, "Now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Soho, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Soho and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with a valley between them." Alrighty, so a lot of places I'd never heard of. So I found this map online, which really helped me out a lot. So you kind of see, that's of course modern, this modern area. That's the Elah Valley. And in some points, this valley is almost a mile wide. It's huge. You see, you've got the Philistine camp on one side of the valley. You got the Israelite camp on the other side. You see, back in the far corner is Gath. That's where Goliath was from. And Azekah and Soho, this is Judah territory. And so the word for this area, Ephes-Damim, means boundary of blood. It was the borderland between Philistine country and Israel, Judah's tribal land specifically. A lot of fighting took place here over the centuries. So that's where we are in our text. It's the ancient valley of Elah. It was crucial for Israel to maintain control of this valley, because if the Philistines took it, they could send raiding parties into the villages in Judah as frequently as they wanted to. And verse 4 tells us that Goliath, the Philistines' great champion, this giant from Gath, comes walking out of the Philistine war camp toward the armies of Israel across that very valley. Now, I want to talk about Goliath for a minute. I hope that's okay. In studying chapter 17, I was reminded of a conversation that I had with a dear friend a while back about Goliath and David and this whole story. Because, you know, it's got to be the most well-known battle story in the whole Bible, right? Even people who are not familiar with church, they've heard of David and Goliath. We use it as analogies for everything. Well, in that conversation, my buddy asked me how tall I thought Goliath was. And I told him that I didn't think his actual height really mattered, because for me, there's so much more going on here in chapter 17 than that. And personally, I think getting hung up on exactly how tall Goliath was distracts you from seeing the more important elements of this story. Well, he didn't like that answer. He wanted a number. So I told him that I believe, based on textual evidence, that Goliath was somewhere around 6'6". And he came unglued. Kind of scary. I think it was the textual evidence part that set him off. You know, I didn't mean to come off sounding like a snob, but it probably did sound that way. And my friend proceeded to lecture me on what the measurement of a cubit was, and how the Bible specifically says that Goliath was 6 cubits in a span, and how there's no way that would ever translate to 6'6". And he knew his stuff. You could tell this was real important to him. It's something he spent a lot of time looking into. And toward the end of our conversation, he wanted to know exactly what textual evidence I was referring to. He kept throwing that term back at me, which is fine. That's fine. Because to him, it was very clear. Okay. And I'll just be up front with you. I don't like explaining this kind of stuff from the pulpit because we can't have any dialogue, right? I think subjects like this are best handled through conversations. So if I don't do a good job with this and I say something that makes zero sense, will y'all please let me know afterwards? Because I want to be a good communicator. You're not going to hurt my feelings at all. So here's the condensed version of what I told him. But before that, let me say this. This is what's crazy about this whole conversation to me up to this point. This whole uncomfortable conversation he and I are having is centered around cubits. This antiquated unit of measurement that was never consistent. It's like today somebody asking you how big something was and you went, about yay, somewhere in there. That's what we're dealing with. It's such a stupid thing to argue about, but whatever. Here goes. So most modern Bibles use the 6-cubit measurement for Goliath. And that's based on the traditional Hebrew version of the Old Testament. Now, the version of that, which most translators use, wasn't completed until the 10th century AD. Okay? So we're talking around 900 years after Jesus was born. The Greek version of the Old Testament, which most of the New Testament writers quote from, and this sounds really weird to say, is actually much older than the accepted Hebrew version. Okay? And the Greek version has Goliath at 4 cubits and a span, as does the Jewish historian Josephus, who's very well respected. Now, when you factor in the Dead Sea Scrolls, which weren't discovered until the late 1940s, the overwhelming amount of textual evidence that we currently have uses the 4-cubit measurement. Now, I'll say again, I do not care how tall Goliath was. I really do not think it matters. He could be 40 foot tall and shoot lightning out of his fingertips. I do not care. And here's why. Because most anthropologists estimate that the average adult Hebrew male at this time in history was about 5'1" to 5'4". So if I'm there with Saul in Israel's camp, and I see Goliath walking across that valley, whether you tell me he's 7 foot, 10 foot, or 40 foot, I really don't care. All I see is a monster straight out of a really bad dream. Right? And y'all, it is so frustrating to me that this is the kind of stuff that some Christians get hung up on. Cubits. Cubits. Now, I will say, I do think it comes from a good place. I think as Bible people, we sometimes have this tendency to feel like we need to defend every number and every word that's in here. Like somehow if a copyist misspelled something, or a stat turns out to be wrong, or a number got missed or changed, that somehow that makes the entire Bible untrustworthy and we ought to just throw it in the trash. It's ridiculous. It's a ridiculous argument. So what if there is a discrepancy in numbers between two ancient texts? So what? You know where there is no discrepancy? In the telling of this historical event in 1 Samuel 17. David steps to Goliath, sling and stones in hand, drops him with one headshot, then takes Goliath's own sword and cuts his head off. Every manuscript, every scroll, every legible fragment of the thousands of copies of this account that exist today tell that exact same story. But we want to attack each other over cubits. You know what the only biblical number that really matters is? One. One. One body, one spirit, one hope. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all. The God of the universe has preserved and protected all of His inspired writings in order to give us this one unified story that leads to His Son Jesus. That's what this is. That's what this is. Now, are there differences in some of the source materials? Sure. But we're talking about statistics and names. And the names are usually due to spelling errors when the manuscripts were copied. This is ancient material we're dealing with in languages that aren't around anymore. We're talking about numbers and measurements. Nothing that has anything to do with or compromises in any way God's great purpose for His book. Nothing. Okay, I'm done. Let's get back to the book. So, Goliath is standing in the valley. He is screaming at Israel's war camp. He wants one guy to come forward and fight him, winner take all. It's an old concept called single combat. Y'all ever watch that movie Troy with Brad Pitt? When he plays the Greek warrior Achilles. And remember, Achilles and Hector, who was the prince of Troy, they fought one-on-one. That's single combat. Winner take all. That's what Goliath is asking for. Problem is, no Israelite wants any part of it. Can't say I blame him. But y'all, this is where Saul is supposed to step up. But instead, verse 11 says that when Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. You know, fear doesn't always lead to cowardice, but that's what we got here. And for the enlisted guys, okay, most of them are farmers and herdsmen. They're used to wrangling with sheep or goats, not a monster like Goliath. But Saul is king over God's people. He is their leader and their protector, and he's a coward. But y'all, it wasn't always like this. Listen to 1 Samuel 14, verses 47 and 48. They say, when Saul had taken the kingship over Israel, he fought against all his enemies on every side, against Moab, against the Ammonites, against Edom, against the kings of Zobah, and against the Philistines. Wherever he turned, he routed them. And he did valiantly and struck the Amalekites and delivered Israel out of the hands of those who plundered them. So Saul was a warrior. He was fierce and he was strong. So what happened to Saul? Well, we talked about it last week. The Spirit of the Lord departed from Saul. Israel's hero, their champion, is now shaking in his tent, too scared to fight for his people. It's really sad. Y'all want to know how bad it got? Not only did Saul refuse to face Goliath in single combat, he tried to bribe one of these goat herders or wheat farmers to offer themselves up to that big ogre instead. He promised a cash prize, said he'd exempt the man's family from having to pay taxes, and he'd throw in one of his daughters too. Such a great leader. But even with all that incentive, he could not get any takers. Nobody wanted anything to do with this. That is, until David showed up. In verses 12 through 18 of chapter 17, tell us why David showed up. He wasn't there to fight. He did not come there looking for combat. His dad asked him to take some food and some supplies to his three oldest brothers who were there with Saul, because they had enlisted to fight with the army. And Jesse, their dad, he was concerned about his boys, and he wanted David to take this stuff to them and then come back and tell him how they were doing. So, of course, David goes, and when he gets there, he leaves the supplies with the folks who are supposed to look after that kind of stuff, and he runs down to his brothers who were down near the valley floor with the other enlisted guys. And as David's talking with his brothers, Goliath steps out and starts to cross the valley again. Verse 18 tells us that Goliath would do this twice a day, every day, begging an Israelite to come fight him. And I love the way the ESV, which is what this version of the Bible is, the way it translates verse 23. Here's the verse. As he talked with them, he being David, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before. And David heard him. Y'all see the foreshadowing in that sentence? Something's coming. Bad news for Goliath. It's coming. Let's keep reading. Verse 24. All the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. And the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel, and the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. And David said to the men who stood by him, what'd you just say? David caught David's attention. He goes on and says, "For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" And the people answered him in the same way, "So this shall be done to the man who kills him." So earlier when I said I thought there were more important elements to this story than Goliath's height, this is one of them. This is one of them. The amount of Israelites gathered in this valley numbered in the thousands. They'd been here for over a month. And none of them, not even their king, could see past their fear. But David could. Because David sees as God sees. Because David's heart is like God's heart. David knew this was much bigger than army versus army or champion versus champion. This was the enemies of Israel versus the mighty God of Israel. David knew, just like he tells Goliath later on at the battle line, that this battle belongs to the Lord. And you know, I don't want to be too critical of the Israelites here because I do that same thing. I try to fight my way with my limited abilities and my own feeble strength, forgetting that every battle I face belongs to the Lord. Every one of them. You think I know better by now. But I guess dumb's hard to fix. You know, I wonder sometimes if the reason that I am so stubborn about this is because the way I see it, if I can fix this, then I get to fix it my way, right? I can maintain this absurd idea of control that I think I have, where if I turn this battle over to Jesus, he may not do things the way I want them done, right? Or I may have to endure some kind of hardship that I really don't want to deal with. Or do I even consider Jesus at all? Or am I just like these scared Israelites shaking in their tents? Because there's no way I can overcome what's in front of me. There's no way I can do that, so I'm not even going to try. Mine. That me monster. He's as full grown as Goliath. I am so short-sighted. I am so selfish. But David's not. Not here. He doesn't see things that way. And because he has the courage to declare it publicly, he gets big brothered. I don't know who's got a big brother in here, but y'all probably been in this exact same situation. Look at verse 28. "Now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men. And Eliab's anger was kindled against David. And he said, 'Why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle.' And David said, 'What have I done now? Was it not but a word?'" Eliab was such a jerk. I mean, it's no wonder God didn't want to make him king, right? You think he's a little jealous of his baby brother? Maybe a little bit? I mean, Eliab was standing in his dad's living room when Samuel anointed David as the next king of Israel. Maybe he just never really got over that. And now he's got little bro talking big in front of his army buddies. So Eliab decides he's going to get his shots in. "Why are you here, David? Why are you here? That handful of sheep, of dad's sheep that you call a herd, where are they? I hope you got somebody to watch them. Hate to lose 3 sheep." And you know, brothers do this, right? Guys do this. It's just a way of endearing ourselves to each other. But then Eliab makes some very telling statements. He says, "I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle." Isn't it peculiar how easy it is for us to see our sin in somebody else, but not in ourselves? I mean, I don't know if Eliab was mad at David because he thought David was like trying to stir the guys up just so he could see a fight. You think he would know his brother better than that? Plus, accusing his little brother of being arrogant and wicked when he came all this way to bring you stuff that you needed? That seems a little harsh. And saying those things in front of the other soldiers, it's like Eliab's trying his best to make David look dishonest and sneaky, so maybe he can overlook his own cowardice for a little while. He can't think about how big a failure he is if he's slamming David. And you can tell his comments caught David off guard, because David says, "What do I do now?" Right? He's like, "Eliab, I just asked a question, bud. That's all." In verse 30 says that David turned away from his brother and started talking with someone else. See, that again shows us David's heart. He's not going to get into it with Eliab. He's not. He gets enough of that trash at home. He's not doing it here. If big brother wants to be petty and small, let him. David just walks away. He finds someone else to talk to. He talks to several more people, just trying to understand the situation that's going on. And eventually, David's concerns find their way back to Saul. And Saul wants to talk to him. Saul's probably thinking, "Hey, that's my music man. Why is he even here?" And their conversation is where we'll pick this story up next week. So let me pray for us.